Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. First package in the list today is nghttp2. This is a C library implementing HTTP versions 1.1, I guess, 2, and 3. It does not include binaries like nghttp, which is an application you could use to, for instance, query an HTTP server. So this is exclusively, it's just the header files pretty much. So if you're writing a C program and you want to communicate over HTTP, here's the library for that. Okay, that's an easy one. It's out of the way. Let's get to the fun one, which is Nmap. Nmap is a network scanner. It is really useful if you're managing a network because it is really your eyes and ears on that network, or maybe just your eyes. But I mean, it's one of the tools that you have to really probe your network and find out what's going on within that domain. I mean, like a literal domain, I guess. But yeah, like that domain. What is happening on your network? Why do you need to know this? Well, it's because, like, we often think of computer systems as something that someone has set up and designed, and therefore it's kind of static and it's a known entity. But a network isn't like that. It's like infrastructure. You're really inviting any number of people, and maybe it's a set number of people, maybe it's just the people in the organization. Well, yeah, but they're all running lots of different applications. All of these things, I mean, there's so many things that could happen on a network that are unknown to you, and you can't know them as an admin. You shouldn't have to think about them normally. Like, part of the design is that things can happen out there on that network that you don't have to think about. You don't have to worry about it. Things are kind of more or less taking care of themselves. And that's the ideal. But what happens then is that you come back in the morning, you know, and you don't know what your network looks like. Like, you think you probably have some idea. Like, you probably know, well, there's, once everyone gets here to work, it's going to be about, you know, I don't know, 200 hosts. So I know that because, you know, I've got computers, I got printers. So that'll be there. And then on this subnet, or, you know, over on this network or whatever, however you have it designed, there'll be the Wi-Fi stuff. And that's a little bit less of a known quantity because people have their mobile devices and stuff like that, you know, or whatever. So in short, you just don't know what your network, what's happening on your network, and you shouldn't have to know. You don't want to always know what's happening on the network, but sometimes you do need to know. And I think Nmap is really good at helping you kind of get a snapshot, get a picture in your head of what that network is looking like. And checking in regularly, you start to form a sort of a default standard picture of your network. It may not always be exactly the same, but you kind of know what to expect. So to get started with Nmap, I mean, the first thing, I think the easiest thing, is really just to scan your network. And I mean, even if it's just your home network, it's not a bad idea to just do an Nmap scan. Why not? Like, there are probably devices in your house that you forgot get an IP address. So you can do that. You just have to know how to express your network. And generally speaking, in the classless inter-domain routing system, CIDR, you've got your IP address. Like, let's say it's 192.168.0.0, or you know, like whatever XXX, like whatever that last number would be for any given host. So as a network, we could just call that 0.192.168.0.0, and then /24 for the mask of the network, the mask bits, which resolves to 255.255.255.0, meaning that the thing that is the values that are available to you is just that last triplet. So it's not 255.255.255. Those are taken. Those have those have a number assigned to them. But that last one, zero, there's no mask there. You can do whatever you want to with that bit. It's that is the wild card. So if your home network is, let's say, 10.0.0.0, then probably your network could be expressed as 10.0.0.0/24. If it is 192.168.0.0, then /24. That expresses probably the entirety of your network. Now, if you have set some kind of constraint within your router to only allow, I don't know, 128 hosts on your network for some reason. I mean, that, and I'm not saying for some reason flippantly, that's not a bad, you know, most home networks probably don't need more than 128. So maybe you want to limit it, who knows? Then that final mask bit could be different. But I'll just assume, you know, the whole network, generally speaking, we could say /24, depending on the network. So in map 10 dot for my little virtual network here, in map 192.168.122.0/24. And then in map starts and it does a little report for what it finds. It shows you open ports. It shows you each different host that it finds on your network. It tells you how many ports it has scanned on that host and what state they're in. They might be open ports, they might be closed, they might be ignored, filtered. It'll tell you about what it finds. It may not have found anything useful. So for one of my little virtual hosts, 192.168.122.173, it says all 1,000 scanned ports on 173 are in ignored states, not shown. 1,000 closed TCP ports, con refused. But on my 192.168.122.82, I've got 997 closed ports, and then it gives me a report on the open ones that it found. Port 22, TCP is open, running SSH. Port 631, TCP is open, running IPP. 5900 TCP is open, running VNC. So that gives you a pretty good picture of, like, maybe not who exactly, but what you have on your network, you know, that you have a host, and that maybe one of those hosts is running a service that its user may or may not even know about. They might not be aware that they've got their SSH port open because they just clicked a share button in a settings file somewhere. It didn't tell them it was SSH. They don't know the difference, and so it's just open. Maybe that doesn't matter. Maybe you're behind a firewall. You don't care, but maybe it is important. Maybe it's something to be aware of. Okay, so that's the basic scan. That's the entry point to nmap. You can scan specific ports with a dash P for ports. So dash P22 would just scan the for port 22 on some host or, again, a whole network. Or you could do a quick scan of machines without reporting so much on the port with dash SN, formerly dash S capital P. It stands for a scan ping or a ping scan. And sometimes that's useful because if you just want a list of hosts on your network, you don't care so much about what they may or may not be running. You just do a nmap dash SN, or again, dash S capital P, but that's, I think that's the deprecated version. So dash SN is what you actually want to use. Nmap dash SN 192.168.122.0/24. It'll give you a report about each host. So you get an IP address. There's 192.168.122.82. There's the 173. There's the 222, and so on. So you get a list of the hosts, which is nice. And you can, you know, kind of grep that or awk it and get just a list of IP addresses, for instance. And there are output formats that you can use to make that even more explicit. Like there is a dash O capital X to give you XML. Don't know why you would want that, but you never know. I mean, nothing against XML. I love XML, but I just can't imagine using that myself, but I'm sure there are lots of applications that do. Dash O capital G for what they call grepable, which gives you things in like column form, basically, like host colon 192.168.122.82 status up, you know, and it's all delimited by semi or by colons, and it's, you know, each item gets one line, and it's, you know, it's I wouldn't say it's less verbose because it is it's verbose, but it gives you the data rather than sort of descriptions of what it's giving you. There's also, so if you're doing a scan for ports and you want to find the open ports specifically, then the option for that would be a dash S capital V as in Victor, not P as in port or papa if you do the NATO alphabet. Dash S capital V option scans a port to determine the service and the version of that service running on the port. And then the dash dash open option provides, or rather limits, the results to just the open ports. So if you don't care about the getting reports on things that aren't anything but open, then those two options can be pretty useful together. So you do like inmap 192.168.1.122.0/24-P22, because you just want to find out, is anyone running an open, you know, is anyone's port 22 open running a service, dash S capital V for that, and then dash dash open to constrain that report to just the open things. So the SV is the service and the version, and then the dash dash open is the thing that just gives you the open hits that it finds. So in my scan of my virtual network, it turns out that my 8.2 host is running port 22, that is 22 TCP open SSH, and it has determined that the open SSH version that it is running is 8.8 protocol 2.0. So that can be useful, as you can imagine. So there are other tricks you can do with InMap to look at a network, and it doesn't always have to be your network. And that's the interesting thing about InMap, is that it is a network scanner, meaning that you or anyone with InMap could be looking at a network. What you find there may or may not matter, right? But it is like, if information gathering is part of your research for whatever you need to do, then InMap is a really, really good way to gather information. So for instance, let's say you want to look at a specific network and just find out what kinds of things are on that network. I mean, normally, like, that could be you don't necessarily get that much information by getting a list of IP addresses, right? So you can define dash dash DNS servers, or sorry, dash dash DNS dash servers. You can define your own server or groups of servers for DNS reverse DNS lookups. Now, by default, InMap will just use whatever it finds in your resolve.conf, which is probably fine. But you can define your own, which, according to the man page, kind of boosts, you know, sort of your stealth score, as it were, because your requests could be bounced off just about any number of recursive DNS servers, you know, around the internet. So you're not broadcasting the source of your queries quite as loudly when you do it that way. So here's what that looks like. So let's say there's the nghttp2.org server, which nghttp2 advertises on its website as a test server that you can use to, you know, when you're programming your C library, your C program, and you're using the nghttp library, you could use that server to kind of test HTTP requests and headers and things like that. So we'll just use it for this, not for anything nefarious. It's as good as anything. I mean, there's example.com as well, but I think it could be interesting since nghttp2 was one of the packages from today. Let's just kind of look around that network. So you can type in host nghttp2.org and then space 8.8.8.8. That just gives you the numbers assigned to nghttp2.org. That's a standard, you know, that's not InMap, that's just a net utility, whatever the package for host was called. That's just a standard kind of like lookup. So it looks like nghttp2.org is hosted on a server with the number 139.162.123.134. There's also an IP version 6 address here, and its mail has, there's a mail server as well. All right, so that's standard host stuff, but what I really just wanted was that number, which is the 139.162.123.134. So now we can use dash S capital L, and that is, and you shouldn't do this to just any network. I mean, you could, you know, you could offend people, but I mean, not really. I mean, this isn't that big of a deal, but do be careful when you go prowling around on the internet. You can set off, not alarms, but you could set off things that could block you. So be mindful when you're doing this and try to do this on servers that are like sort of acknowledge that, hey, we're a test bed for things. So -S-L gets you a list of the hosts on a network along with the domain names that they resolve to. So in map --DNS servers 8.8.4.4, 8.8.8.8-S-L-139.162.123.134/24. And I'm going to actually redirect that into a text file because it's going to be probably a lot. And after it's finished scanning, it is indeed a lot. So there's an in-map scan report for 139.162.123.234.ip.linode-user-content.com. And that goes on for about five hosts. And then there's a .9.members.linode.com, 10, 11 members. Yeah, so a bunch of things that don't really even... Oh, here's something. vps2.imreadygo.com. That's 139.162.123.22. Here's another one. That's a jumble of letters. I'm not even going to bother reading that, actually. Yeah, so you get a report on, like, literally just all the hosts on that network. Now, what good is this really? It's not really good for anything, really. But, I mean, it could be if you're looking for a specific server. You know, you've been receiving spam from someplace or you've had a phishing attempt from someplace and you want to see, well, what, you know, is this a reportable type of thing, or is it on like a farm of ridiculous ridiculous domain names that are clearly all just a bot farm? So, you know, that can be quite useful in itself, just to kind of investigate, like, what kind of network is this that I'm dealing with? Because sometimes it's a legitimate VPS or cluster, and one of the hosts has been compromised and is being used for nefarious purposes. And so that's worth reporting to someone, because probably they actually do care about that. But if you look at the thing and it's just a bunch of obviously fly-by-night domain names that don't expect to survive, you kind of get the feeling, you know, like, oh yeah, I could just block that entire network and never regret it. So that's something that InMap can help with. Now, there are a bunch, I mean, obviously there's a bunch more you can do with InMap, but there's even more you can do with InMap by way of scripting. And amazingly, InMap ships a bunch of scripts with InMap. The InMap scripting engine, or NSE, that's a .nse file, which is actually Lua. These are scripts written for InMap, and there are 605 of them or something like that. It's over 600, just a little over 600 in /user/share/inmap/scripts, I think. And there's a bunch of them out there, just scripts for lots of different, most of their names kind of hint at what they do. There's some for like penetration testing, like HTTP-brute. That's a brute force attempt through some HTTP means, usually through an HTTP form, I think. But there's also something like vulners, V-U-L-N-E-R-S. That's a really, really useful one, actually, because it'll look at a host or a network. I kind of prefer to go by host for this one because it can be a lot of information. And it'll report on CVE, you know, like open exploits that it finds for something relevant to what you are running. So for instance, if I do inmap --PN-SV-P22, so that's port 22, --script equals vulners, VULNERS, and it knows, InMap knows where to find it. So you don't have to do the full path. You don't have to give it the .nse extension. You just give it the script name. And then in my case, 192.168.122.82, it scans for that for very briefly. It looks at port 22. It is open. It is running OpenSSH 8.8. And what do you know? There's a CVE-2023-38408, 9.8. vulners.com/CVE-CVE-38408 eventually. Oh, that's what it was. Yeah. Yeah. So there's vulnerabilities, known vulnerabilities for that specific version of SSH. So would I want that SSH to be exposed to the world? Probably not. That would probably be risky to do. So that's a really useful scan done through a really useful script. Now that's a simple script, and all it needs, well, it doesn't need anything really. I mean, the script is what it is. Some scripts require arguments to be passed to the script, and you have to do that through InMap. So, and then you have to know what arguments you have to pass to the script, and that can be tough. You usually have to just look at the script, to be honest. ZenMap can help with that a little bit, because it has like a GUI and a way of interpreting scripts so that you kind of know what to look for. But if you're just doing it in the terminal with InMap, just be aware of that. If you're using a script that's sort of more advanced, or I guess not advanced, it's just a script that requires, you know, additional context, then you may have to give it arguments. And those arguments may only, they might not even be standard, or they'll be standard arguments, but I mean, they, not all of them might apply. Like if you're trying to see if your HTTP form is secure or not, then, you know, you might have to tell the script what form to attempt to run through a rainbow table on before you can get useful results. So it is nice, because like it's a whole other application all of a sudden. It's like a script, and it's just, InMap will just do all kinds of things that if you had to do it yourself, you wouldn't even know where to start. But the trade-off there is that you now have to know where to start just to use the script. So it can get quite complex. But, you know, you do a little bit of research, you see a couple examples of how people are doing it. You look at the source code of the thing that you're testing, or the API, or, you know, whatever, the network settings, whatever you need, and then you pass that on to the script, you press go, and it goes. So that's a really useful one, really useful thing to know about. It makes, I mean, InMap alone is already useful, but the scripts, I mean, it's just, like I say, it's like 605, or, you know, maybe, I don't know, 300 new applications embedded within InMap, just using InMap as its foundation and doing all kinds of things. I mean, that's the nature of scripting. So it's pretty amazing. Check that out. Let's go get a cup of coffee. We'll come back and finish up the show. Okay, we're back, and I've got coffee that I brewed on my fire, my wood burning oven, or whatever it's called, the wood burner burner. It's winter here in New Zealand right now as I record this, and so it is very cold, and so I've got a fire going today, and I just put my little mocha pot on there, and it is surprisingly quick, is what I'm trying to say. It wasn't just the 30 seconds of the music. I did have to stop that, but it was pretty darn quick, and it's great. It tastes really good. I mean, yes, it's not any different than just doing it over a stovetop, really, but I mean, it's still, it tastes good, and it was, the molecules were motivated by heat. Okay, let's do some listener feedback, which we haven't had in a while. This one's from Deep Geek. He says, "Hope all is well on your end. Wanted to tell you about a cool piece of software I found. My home computing situation has evolved, and now I need the ability to run something on my desktop computer, detach it, and pick it up on my laptop in another route. Of course, another room. Of course, I refer back to your Tmux episode. However great it is to do this with a terminal, a shell, that leaves the question of GUI apps. There is, of course, X-forwarding with SSH, but this does not allow for detaching in the middle of using an app. And not all apps are hospitable to being forwarded in this way, and that's true, and work better with a VNC style forwarding. Now, I did experiment with actual VNC, remote desktop, on Linux, but I did not want a desktop known as a rootful experience. I just wanted the GUI app running remotely. Then I found Xpra, that's X-P-R-A, which brings a Tmux-like workflow with a VNC style forwarding and the ability to attach and detach from an application. It's not perfect. You need to avoid some pitfalls like having your default X session kicking off all kinds of desktop environment widgets, which all get forwarded as freestanding GUI apps, or having applications start using something like the OpenGL on NVIDIA and then switching to OpenGL on Intel. Some apps don't really like having that happen after they start, but the command line for starting Xpra, while being pretty hairy, can be set with some patience to overcome these issues. While finding the GUI apps can run quite a bit, I'm finding that the GUI apps can run quite a bit slower remotely rather than locally on a slower laptop, but there are some situations where this is better, like checking RSS feeds with all my feed positions stored on the main computer, or web banking where the bank fingerprints your browser and puts you through a round of two-factor authentication if you use a different browser. So XPRA is the name of that application. I'd not heard of it personally. And yeah, that does sound pretty cool. I really think for me, like the next ongoing, I guess, complaint I'm going to have, it used to be notifications, the location of notifications. And it is still ongoing that I want all file choosers to be able to be standardized across a system. Like if I go to LibreOffice and go to open a file, then I want that file chooser to be the same as the one that I find in, I don't know, some other application where you open files. Oh, Inkscape, or whatever. Like I want the user to be able to control that. That said, I've recently been using enough other applications that are kind of like bespoke, you know, they have bespoke solutions. And I have to admit, I'm actually starting to lighten up on that one. It's kind of like, okay, it is a bit jarring, but at the same time, like, you know, like, I don't know, there's a world of computing out there where people just don't mind variety, you know, and standardization is great and it has its strengths. But I don't know, maybe I'm going, you know, then again, maybe it's just, again, your user preference. Like, what do you, the user, want? Do you want the variety, or do you want some kind of override switch where you say, hey, every application on my computer, when I say open a file or save a file, bring up the same exact file chooser every single time? I think, yeah, I think that option would be cool to have. So anyway, the next complaint after that is going to be, I think, just getting things from one system to another. And we've seen cool thing, like there was a thing where you run this daemon on two computers, and you can set the two computers up next to each other, and your mouse can go from one screen right into the next screen. So you're using the same mouse, just depending on, you know, which monitor you're on. I forget what that was called. It was a while ago, long time ago now, 12 years ago. I mean, it might still be around, but that's when I heard about it. And then this XPRA, which is the screen for X. I just saw what does XPRA actually stand for? Persistent root application or something like that. I don't know. And yeah, that seems kind of cool. So if you go to github.com/xpra-org/xpra, XPRA, then you can find out more about that application. I have not actually even tried it. I've logged it for future use because I don't think I have a use for it at this moment in my life. I just kind of don't. But I think it is very cool, and I could see myself using it later if my workflow changes. Or I could see definitely recommending it to other people. Well, I'd want to try it before I recommended it, obviously. But that's a cool one. XPRA. Check it out. Okay, next package is the NN package. That's a newsreader for the terminal. In order to use this, you have to set up your NNTP server in the /etc/NNTP server file. Or I guess you can have an NNTP server that literally just an NTP server as an environment variable, and it'll take it from that as well. I didn't try that myself. I just popped news.eternal-september.org/etc/nntp server. Not that I'm like recommending eternal-september.org. I'm just saying that's an available one that you can browse without having to go through a whole lot of authentication stuff. Interestingly, I couldn't actually find out how to authenticate because I do have an account there. And I thought, well, don't I need to sign in? But I couldn't figure out how to sign in. But it let me on anyway. So I don't know where it's getting this information or why I ever needed an account there. I'm not sure. But anyway, put news.eternal-september.org in your /etc/nntp server file and then type nn in a terminal and it logs into or it interfaces with news.eternal-september.org and it shows you a bunch of posts. Navigation in this application takes a lot of practice, I will say that. And there are like layers and layers of threads. And so you go into one thread and then there's a bunch of threads within that thread. And I never really got from like, I was trying to translate everything over to Pan, like what I saw in Pan, and I just couldn't. I couldn't figure out which news group I was in. And maybe that's because I wasn't authenticated and I was just in the big public news group. Maybe I was just on the one news group. I'm not sure. It was pretty confusing, but you do kind of start to get the hang of it. The keyboard shortcuts I would argue are not super intuitive. It's like capital X to read a post, and then I forget even how to get back out of the post. I tried back arrow, I tried B for back, did I try escape? I don't think I tried escape, to be fair. Anyway, it's capital Q to quit. You'll want to know that, and then question mark for help. If you press question mark while you're in that application, it does give you a help screen, and you will have to copy that help screen and refer to it frequently as you go because it is just not intuitive. You will press buttons that you know from other applications or that seem intuitive to you just from what they look like on your keyboard, and they will not do a thing that you would imagine they would do. I didn't love using NN for the like half hour that I used it. Maybe it was more like an hour. I really tried to get used to it. But I mean, an hour with an application is nothing, right? I mean, that's really, really nothing. So I'm not even saying it's confusing or obtuse. I'm just saying I didn't get used to it. I don't see myself using it because, again, I don't really use news groups all that much, or user groups, whatever they're called. What are they called? Usenet. I don't really use Usenet yet. And if I do, I could see myself using NN, but I would have to really look into like the whole account settings thing because in my cursory glance over the man page and stuff, I just couldn't figure out how to authenticate, which for more active user Usenet groups, servers, I think you really would need that option. So, but yeah, I mean, definitely one would want a newsreader in a terminal, right? I mean, that just seems not correct, but I mean, it does kind of seem correct. You're going to want that. You know, like if you're using Usenet, you're going to want it in the terminal eventually, probably, or maybe not. Like I say, Pan is a really nice application, and I assume I've either talked about it before or will talk about it soon, because I don't remember talking about it, but I wouldn't have then because I wouldn't have known about Eternal September. So now that I'm on Eternal September a little bit, I'm actually using Usenet a very tiny amount, and it is nice. I don't not like it. It is nice. So NN, that's a newsreader. Next up is NPTH. NPTH. This is a GNU portable threads library. It was developed again with like a bunch of these libraries for GNU PG, and it's a threading library. So if you need your application to do to work in threads, to do several tasks at the same time, this is a library that would help you do that. Apparently this was developed because they were porting GNU PG over to Windows, I think, and they had to come up with some other solution for that, and then they realized, well, what we were using anyway wasn't that great, so let's replace it with this, or something like that. I'm kind of paraphrasing something that I saw on LWN, but it's a threading library developed for GNU PG, but you know, it's a library, so you can use it in whatever. There is a debate on LWN about coroutines versus threads. It seems like a pretty hot topic. I guess go there if you want to read more. NSS-PAM-LDAPD. This allows your LDAP server to provide a user account, group, hostname, alias, netgroup, and pretty much any information that you would normally get from a /etc. And that's kind of what LDAP, that's one of the things that LDAP does, is it provides configuration information to hosts over a network. We'll talk a little bit more about that before the end of this episode. Not too much, though. Okay, after NSS, PAM, LDAPD, there's the NTP package, which includes NTPD, and this is kind of an important one, because this doesn't come on by default on Slackware. I mean, I don't think, very few daemons come on, are on by default. I mean, I'm sure some of them are, but very few of them. So when you're installing, one of the last steps is like, what do you want to run at startup? And I used to skip this NTPD because I thought, well, I don't want to run a time server. I'm not a time server. I'd rather just get my time from a time server, like a real time server. That's not what this is. NTPD is the thing that checks the time for you. So if you're running Slackware and you notice that your clock seems to drift, it's because you're not running NTPD probably. Or if you are, you don't have your time server set correctly. There is an ntp.conf file, which you can look at and edit if you have sudo or root permissions. I think on, you know, line, I don't know, call it line 10. It's a little bit ways down the file. There are two time servers listed. I don't think I put those in myself. One is like clock.corp.redhat.com, and the other is time.apple.com. Both of those, I guess, are pretty reliable. I've always used time.apple.com because that's the one that's kind of like really easy to remember, time.apple.com. Like that's easy to remember. So that's what I generally use. And that's what I have in that file in ntp.conf in the /etc directory. But for that to get used by your NTP daemon, of course, your NTP daemon has to be running. And the way that you do that is you do sudo chmod plus x /etc/rc.d/rc.ntpd. That enables that daemon, that startup file. And then when you boot, ntpd, the daemon starts, and at some point during that day, and maybe right away, I don't know how, I haven't verified like how often it checks, but it checks time.apple.com or clock.corp.redhat.com and figures out what the internet says the time is, and it adjusts your clock. And it's usually, you know, like, oh, you're 1 second off, or you're 0.06 of a second off. You know, it's not a whole lot unless you go for days without running this. Then it might be a full like 10 second drift or something like that, which is what was happening to me for a little while, because I hadn't enabled NTPD. So once you enable that, your clock will be correct more often, which is nice. All right, after that one, NTPD, or NTP rather, and there's a bunch of utilities in NTP, but not all of them are terribly useful necessarily. I think for normal use, like there's something about the tick size and the tick adjust and stuff like that. I don't know. But there is NTP date, which is useful because that updates your clock. So if you've not run, you know, if NTPD isn't running and you do notice that your clock is drifting, you could do a sudo NTP date /time.apple.com, and that'll correct your clock. Again, if you're running the daemon, that won't even be necessary and you won't need it. But there are a couple of little utilities like that in there. But generally, I think what you ought to be doing is sudo chmod plus x /etc/rc.ntpd, and then you're good to go. All right, next is OBEX. Open OBEX and I think OBEX FTP. Those are two different packages, but they're obviously sort of the same. They're together, OBEX and OBEX. Now, this probably won't work for you. It didn't work for me because I don't have an OBEX client to speak with. But the idea of OBEX is, I mean, originally apparently it was developed for IRDA data transfer. So I think that's like, you know, the IR, like a remote control, essentially, like whatever that little thing is in remote controls. Like, and I guess, you know, a long time ago, it was like a Palm Pilot, like these little data pads that people would carry around, and they would have like a little IR light, and you could point them at each other and transfer files just over that. And it was pretty cool. Like it was early, you know, I mean, it wasn't Bluetooth, it was IR, but I mean, that it was early wireless transfer. That's pretty neat. And you can still do that today. Like, if you have a device that gets data and has an IRDA port or whatever, you could transfer data over that with OpenObex. More likely, you have something with Bluetooth, or you have something with, well, TCP, and then you could in theory use OBEX. I was trying it on a couple of different things, and none of them had OBEX clients. I looked in FDroid, couldn't find an OBEX client for my mobile, so I didn't bother. I mean, I think there is one in like Google Play Store, but I didn't want to install that. So you do need, you know, the two devices need to know what OBEX is, in other words. But you could try it yourself. First of all, you need to locate a Bluetooth device, which took me way longer than I care to admit to do. I was trying to pair with my mobile phone, which normally I just do with KDE Connect, which doesn't use Bluetooth. So I was trying to pair the phone with my computer, and it just would not pair. And then I realized you have to sort of be pairing on both devices. You have to tell the phone that you're pairing and your computer that you're pairing, and then they know to like sort of accept each other's requests, give you a PIN, you type in the PIN, or you confirm that the PIN matches, and then finally you're paired. So HCI tool space scan will detect whether or not, you know, that'll confirm whether your computer can find your phone over Bluetooth. So that's an HCI tool is just from the Blues package, which we talked about ages ago. So that's not OBEX. That's just to kind of confirm, yes, I have a Bluetooth device. It is paired. It's here. My Bluetooth is on, you know, stuff like that. You have to make sure that you've got your Bluetooth enabled on your computer, because it won't work without that. And then you can do something like OBEX FTP-B for Bluetooth. You can just leave it blank and it'll just take the first Bluetooth device it finds. So if you do have a lot of Bluetooth devices, then you do have to give it the HCI, code of that Bluetooth device from like HCI dump, I think is what it is. So dash B for Bluetooth, dash P for the path of the file, let's say that you want to send to the device, and then dash C for the directory in that device where you want to put the file. And if you don't use dash C, and it'll just use whatever the default of that device is, apparently. So OBEX FTP dash B dash P /ramdisk/hello world.txt. And in theory, that should sort of reach out onto the Bluetooth airwaves, contact the device that it finds, the first device that it finds, and transfer the file. But I was not able to get it to work because, again, my device just didn't know to be listening for OBEX FTP. So it did not work. But it does seem like a cool application. It seems probably relatively limited in usefulness and scope. But you could try it out if you're either willing to try an OBEX client on your mobile, or maybe you have a device that actually uses that. Next up is OpenResolve. This is an application that helps you manage your resolve.conf file. Normally, that file is either something that you control, or if you're running something like Network Manager, it may be something that something else puts data into. And certainly that's what I have. I have Network Manager kind of running my local, you know, network services. And so when I connect to my work VPN, resolve.conf gets a new line added to it, you know, for a different network, like a completely different place to go for certain IP addresses. I didn't put it there. Network Manager puts it there. So OpenResolve, the command for that is resolveconf, confusingly, not resolve.conf, just resolveconf. That allows you it's a script that allows several different things by calling resolveconf to manipulate your /etc/resolve.conf. So it's not, you're probably not going to use it directly. Other plugins or modules are going to use resolveconf. And I couldn't really quite understand how I was supposed to sort of like turn this on. Like, I couldn't tell, maybe is Network Manager on Slackware using resolveconf? Or are other services using resolveconf? Or am I supposed to use it directly? I don't think I'm supposed to use it directly. That seems weird. You can. I mean, you can type in sudo /usr/sbin/resolveconf-l, and you'll get a list of whatever's in your resolve.conf at that moment. So, for instance, you might have search example.com, name server, 8.8. Well, let's say 192.168.122.1, actually, because that was what it was on my virtual machine. Okay, great. So that's that. So now let's put something different into a file, a temporary file. Echo, quote, name server, 8.8.8.8, close quote, redirect into dns.info, and then sudo /usr/sbin/resolveconf dash a for the the device. Sure, dash a for a device, for a network device, okay? So dash a eth 0 in my case, and then redirect into that, so a less than symbol, dns.info. So I'm putting the contents of dns info, which I know is name server 8.8.8.8, into the resolveconf-a eth 0 command. So I'm providing it data from a file. And now if I do sudo user sbin resolveconf-l again, it shows me that, hey, this is resolve.conf from eth 0, name server 8.8.8.8. So it has changed my name server, overwritten my resolve.conf. Obviously not really probably intended for you to do it this way yourself. Like, that doesn't seem very useful. I believe that this is a script for other things to use. I just couldn't figure out from the website how to, or the docs that I read, what uses this? I'm not sure. I could not tell what is using this script to accomplish the management of that file. So I'm not exactly sure where this is getting used. The same developer of OpenResolve is the developer of, for instance, OpenRC, the init system. I mean, was the developer of the init system. Apparently, it's an abandoned project. Or he has it in a section of his website called Projects I Have Abandoned. So I don't know whether that means it's just gone entirely, or whether that means this person has walked away from it and other people are now developing it. I'm not sure. I had not heard that OpenRC went away, but whatever the case, all kind of within the same, same developer and kind of similar things. I mean, I figure that probably OpenResolve is a little bit of a kind of a workaround when things like systemd, you know, are managing, or certainly network manager, are managing resolve.conf. I'm assuming that this is kind of like, well, if we write other systems, how can we have the same functionality but through a different means? That's what I'm guessing this is for. And love to have alternatives. I'm not going to complain. Just don't know how to, like, I don't know why I would need it personally. And if I did need it, I don't know that I'd know how to activate it. But presumably that would be something that, like, you know, in the theoretical world, Pat Volkerding might say, okay, I'm done with Network Manager for whatever reason. Maybe, I don't know, whatever. I'm not going to theorize because this is an imaginary scenario. Done with Network Manager. So we're going to use, you know, this other thing. And for to ensure that all of the other solutions that we are using are not like clobbering each other's configurations, we're going to use resolveconf. And then it would just be set up by the distro maintainer, not by the user. That's what I'm assuming. Either way, this does exist. It's here. So maybe it is being used for some alternatives that I am not using. Could be that. And then the last thing on the list is just a little application called OpenLDAP. Of course, I'm understating it. OpenLDAP is a huge application. It's the backbone of many a corporate network. It is the infrastructure that can provide network-wide authentication. It can provide remote home directories. It can provide remote configuration. Remote contacts. Just it's huge. I mean, it is the IT expression of your organizational structure, and that's where you start. Like, that's the slapd configuration that you start with. It's a configuration file, slapd. I don't know, ldiff or something like that, and you create like a little, essentially a database of all the defaults, the domain that your organization is, the top level domain that it is under, and then you go on and add hosts and and contacts and all of the different things that people are going to need when they come to the organization and sign on to the network, and they need to share information. And it's not, you know, it's not so much about like file shares and things like that. It's more about like sort of identity, really. Like, are you supposed to be in this building at this computer? Do you have the correct credentials? And when you sign in, where, you know, where's your stuff? And that's tricky, because where is their stuff? You want to maybe all of their, maybe you're just running thin clients on at the workstations, or rather at the desks of each person, or maybe you're running full desktops or workstations, but you're backing it up somewhere because you don't want your workers obviously to accidentally lose their work. So you want to make sure that it's stored elsewhere. And certainly with remote home folders, then you have the situation where you can have someone at one desk and they decide, oh, I don't want to sit here right now because I need to, it would be better if I worked over there with that other person, closer to that other person. So they go over there and they sign into the computer over there, and bang, there's their desktop exactly as they left it. But it's here at this physical computer instead of over there at that physical computer, that sort of thing. So LDAP is huge. It provides a lot of different just kind of really infrastructure, kind of organizational conveniences. And it is a beast to configure, to be fair. I mean, it really is. I mean, partly because there are so many options and each organization is literally different. Like, I mean, it's just, you have to configure it for your organization based on what your organizational needs are. And I wouldn't even know where to begin to talk about what to do, but that's what it is. And so if you wanted to run an LDAP server, you could make that your Slackware box. You could run your LDAP server off of Slackware. And again, it can provide so many different services that you'd have to really just kind of pick through the different ones and decide what you actually need. There is a quick start guide, but it's kind of a joke. Like, I mean, it's great that they have it, but they do open their quick start guide by basically saying, don't use this quick start guide. I mean, they say literally, and I quote, if you intend to run LDAP or open LDAP software seriously, you should review all of this document before attempting to install the software. All of this meaning the full documentation. So there is a lot of documentation, and I think to get started with LDAP, you just need to sit down and read the docs and get really familiar with what the options are, what configuration files you're going to need. The good news is that on Slackware, all of that stuff is here, like slapd and all the components that need to be running in order for LDAP to run correctly. They're all here. You don't have to pay attention so much to that. And I feel like sometimes that is kind of the confusing part about certain open source software, is that you go to the documentation and it's like, okay, here's how to build it. And you're like, well, wait, I don't need to build it. I'm on Slackware. Like, it's already done. Like, I don't need to compile it against this library or that library. It's already done. It's already there. So you just configure it and start it, and then you're running LDAP. But it's going to take a while. It's going to take a lot of trial and error, because there are a lot of configuration options that at first glance just don't make any sense. Once you read about it, it makes a lot of sense, because it really is. It is the IT expression of your organization. It's really, really logical. So yeah, go read about it. And if you want, you can run it on Slackware. I think that's all I dare say about Open LDAP, honestly. It's too big of a beast. That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time. Thanks for listening. My name's Klaatu. You can reach me anytime over email with feedback or comments, tips, or just to say hi. My email address is klaatu@slackermedia.info. You can also reach me on the Mastodon network, not Klaatu, at mastodon.xyz. The show's intro and outro music is by Fat Chance Lester. You can find their music on bandcamp.com or on gnuworldorder.info. In the archive, you'll find a music directory containing the album from which this music has been extracted. Until next time, thanks for listening, and keep the source open.
everybody should have something to be interested in.